Welcome back, everyone. Today I sat down with my good friend Nemo Semrat again. He is reporting straight out of Ethiopia. We're talking past developments, where the mining market is today for Ethiopia, and where it's going, and where it has to go from his perspective. I hope you have fun with this one. Let's get going. All right, we're back with Nemo. Hello, Nemo. How are you doing?
Hiya, sir. Nice to be back.
We had you on before. I'm sure it's been a bit more than a year. I haven't looked, but yeah, a lot has changed since then. So time for another update. Before we get started, though, we are at block height 893518. Let's quickly check out where hash price is. Here we go. We are at 46.39 US dollars. Still in the pits of hell, but Bitcoin price going up a little bit at the moment, which helps out. But yeah, Nemo, tell us.
Yeah, that global hash rate has been relentlessly growing. Huh?
Yes, absolutely. Can we see that here as well?
I see 850 exahash. Didn't it hit 8,000?
Yeah, some people told me we've like touched a Zeta hash already, but I think that depends heavily on the moving average that you choose to look at.
Yeah, I heard that it was hit briefly too. But,
how was the last year for you, Nemo? How is your project going? Tell us a bit more for those who don't know what QRB does very briefly. Everybody should go back and listen to the last episode. I'm sorry if you just missed the graphs. Go on YouTube and check those out if you want to see what we saw. But yeah, Nemo, tell us a bit more about QRB, where you guys are today, and how it's going.
Okay, so yeah, QRB Labs, my company's the first Bitcoin miner in Ethiopia. We started the company in 2021. Got the first power purchase agreement, actually, and really introduced the concept to the power company and the whole and the government, and started this industry. But the last year has been very significant because even though we started the company in 2021, we didn't actually start hashing until 24, so 2024. Because of all the stuff we talked about last time, the challenges of bureaucracy and doing business in Ethiopia. So, but yeah, I'm very happy to say that now we're hashing away. We're doing quite a lot of business hosting. You know, we're hosting a lot of miners, and the demand, let's just say, is not the problem. We're constantly getting bombarded with people who want us to host them, but the challenge really is increasing our capacity and the logistics and still some bureaucracy for expansion and so it's been a very very fruitful year, milestone year for us, 2024 and so far in 2025 as well. We're doing quite well.
This episode is sponsored by Hashbranch, the easiest way to mine Bitcoin in the US. Sourcing hardware and rack space usually is a mess. Bad deal structures, misaligned incentives, and no visibility after deployment. I have placed tens of thousands of ASICs in partnership with Hashbranch. What I like most is that they cut through the noise. Fair pricing, aligned terms, and access to hosting that actually works. Use code HASHRATEUP100, visit hashbranch.com today to get $100 off of each miner that you order. That's good to hear. Overview of the landscape in Ethiopia. Where are we today? Do you know roughly how many megawatts are online? Who are the biggest players?
So the last public announcement was now a little dated. It was in October. We had hit, so it was zero megawatts of Bitcoin mining in January 2024. Nobody had started yet. And by October, so then the first actual, by October, it had reached 600 megawatts. And that was publicly given by the power company. And that was at our Africa Bitcoin Mining Summit, that organized by Gamma, of which QRB was the host this past year. GAMRA is the Green African Mining Alliance. So, we had someone from the power company there that they disclosed that, there are 600 megawatts going on. That was in October. Nothing public has been said, but privately, I think it's my estimate is that it's around a gigawatt, maybe 800, 900, maybe a gig. So I would say between 800 and megawatts and a gigawatt is where we are today. And the state of the players. So there was, again, as this was revealed publicly last year, there was about 20 companies that had signed PPAs to power purchase agreements, of which at least half got started. About half of the original bunch never really got off the ground. And then a bunch more have come since then. So in total, I would say, it's probably like 20-ish companies are out there, maybe 25. Vast majority of them are from China, and pretty big. As you can imagine, if you take a gigawatt and divide it by 20 companies or 30 companies, there are 30, lots of 30 megawatts, 20 megawatts, 10 megawatts, 50. So that's the state of the industry where we are today. And it's been I think a great success for the power company. Although one of the things that I've always been afraid of is that the distribution may not be the healthiest right now, location wise. We were fortunate that since we were the first, and we came in with the whole concept that you know very well about stranded energy and how Bitcoin can be beneficial if you're using stranded energy and helps you with electrification and investment in the infrastructure. But unfortunately, the pricing here doesn't quite reflect that. So you get the same price regardless of where you go, more or less. So that means a lot of the newer players that have come in have gone into locations like, to me, don't make sense. Where there isn't excess capacity. So we're starting to have a situation where some Bitcoin mining is competing for power with other users. And since the price of electricity is not market-based, it's like the bread lines in the Soviet Union. Like if you can't adjust the price, then the shelves become empty and you adjust it in a different way by waiting in line. So there's issues. So there's been places where the miners are being asked to curtail, and at the worst, I think there was a point where a couple of places where they had to be curtailed by like all day long. Now it's like a few hours here and there, or reduce it by 15%, or like don't mine between this, for the next 3 hours and things like that. So again, we're lucky because we're in a good location, we're seeing some of the problems of mismatch of supply and demand of energy.
Yeah, you said lucky. I don't think that's luck. I think you went there by design, far away from the load center being Addis Ababa, right? So I don't think you should call that luck. That was entirely by design. Price not reflecting scarcity, and then miners going wherever. Yeah, we're close to the airport. We're here. We're there. We're easily reachable. Of course, that's going to cause issues. But maybe before we get into that sort of as a main topic, can you quickly, because a lot of people associate mining in Ethiopia immediately with the GERD, right? And to my understanding, there's a lot more hydropower available than the power that the GERD can deliver. Can you nevertheless give us a bit of an update on that power project? Do you know how much power that dam is producing today? Has it increased because of Bitcoin mining? Has anybody located close to that dam yet? Or is the stranded power still pretty much available at substations that are connected to different power plants than the hydro dam there, the largest one in Africa.
Yeah, so the GERD continues to progress the capacity, not because of Bitcoin. I mean, I think it was going to be progressing as fast as possible anyway. That's just a huge national priority and to get that online. And the dam, the civil works, like the physical dam itself, has been, you know, pretty much completed for a couple of years now, more than actually probably like 3 years. And then the reservoir filling is almost more than 90% done. So the turbines to actually generate the power, I think, when we last spoke, about a year ago, it was 2 out of 11 planned turbines were in there. Now I think it's 4. Maybe my information is a little bit out of date. It might be 5 or 6. So yeah, it's getting to about half of its planned capacity. And it's just, so it's there, it's generating, and it's a big part of the country's supply. I think the total country's capacity right now is, I think, around six gigawatts, maybe a bit more. And so it's about half. And when it's all said and done, the GERD will have a capacity of 6 or 5 point something gigawatts, and if you add up all the other stuff that's existing and new ones that are coming on in the next couple of years, we should get to 10 gigawatts for the country, with GERD being about half. So that's the big picture. So yeah, GERD is, you know, big source of national pride. It's a big geopolitical issue, as we talked about last time. So it gets all the news headlines, but really it's only about half of the electricity. And my hope, as we'll talk about soon, is that it's the beginning of many, many such projects, because I think 10 gigawatts sounds like a lot. It is a lot for Ethiopia, because when we started this company, the capacity of the country was 2 gigawatts. So now we're at 6. So it's, tripling the electricity generation in a big country is a huge, huge accomplishment. And I think, you know, Ethiopia should be really proud of that. But if you think about it, from a global perspective, with our population, we would need 100 gigawatts to be the world's per capita average. I'm not saying like a rich country level. I'm saying average. If you take the world population and the world's electricity capacity, generation capacity, you have about 1 kilowatt per person in the world. And so we would need 100 gigawatts to get to the average. So that's another 1,000% growth that needs to happen for Ethiopia to be in the middle of the world. So that's how I see our mission, is plus, the trainers to get us to that 100 gigawatts.
All the plus all the transmission capacity as well, right? I mean, that's another expensive part of this whole story, right? You can triple and quadruple and whatever your generation capacity all you want. If the power has nowhere to go, then that's the problem. And, you know, that's what we're going to get into just now. Just briefly, a couple other questions beforehand, before we focus on that. Because there's always fluctuation and a lot of volatility in the jurisdiction in Ethiopia, I just want to get a quick update from you around importation. What's the process currently around importation, selling used machines, maybe reselling machines within Ethiopia? Can you give us some background there? What's possible and what's impossible today?
Yeah, so of course that's crucial. That's what took, you know, from 2021 to 2024. That's what we were struggling with, is getting permission to import the machines. So the regulations as they exist today is you have to get permission every single time, so it's pretty so you have to get a pre-import permit and then where you have to specify exactly how many machines, what type they are, and so on. And then and then after they arrive, you have to get that gets audited, checked, and you have to get an import release permit. And then, of course, there's the usual customs and logistics issues, but really the permission is crucial. That's what makes it very different here. That's the main focus of the way the industry is being sort of controlled and regulated. And the current regulations is you cannot bring used machines. So you're only allowed to bring a new Bitcoin miners, ASICs. And also a new twist that just was added is that the machines have to be more than 120 terahash per second. Yeah. But neither one of these rules makes sense, if you ask me, but those are the rules. Those are two constraints. And then in terms of the selling the machines in the country, when the machines come in, they have to be registered, and you have to say which data center they're going in, and it has to be tied to a particular power purchase agreement. So I wouldn't say there's no law that says it's illegal, but based on the agreement that you signed to in order to get the permission to bring them in, you sign a contract like every single time. And so that says that, okay, these machines will be at this location and then, will be under this PPA, and this is where we're going to be using them. So I suppose you could go back and say, ask for permission to say, okay, we want to sell them to somebody else. And then presumably in theory, I don't think it's practically possible, but in theory, you could, I guess, go and if you're want to sell it to another company that has a PPA or move it to another data center, you could ask for permission. There's no law against it, but I wouldn't assume that you can just do that. Of course, if you want to sell them outside, this is important: is that you can take them back out. There's no restriction on that, right? So
okay.
So if somebody's deployed here and then it doesn't make sense anymore, they're free to take their machines back out of the country.
What are the import and export fees? Because in Paraguay, you're also technically very much allowed to take your machines out, but then you hit with another however many percent, which makes it economically completely unfeasible. Is there an export fee like that or not?
No, not as far as I know. Again, many things, there could be some hidden catch because I don't know anybody has actually done it yet. But, in principle, from what I know, there is no fees for export. I mean, you pay for transportation and storage and then I'm sure that you would have to probably pay some storage because they would have to be inspected and given permission and so on. To leave, but there would be some storage fees on your way out. But no, I don't think there's any taxes for taking them out. As far as coming in, there's normal import duties on this, on this type of stuff would normally be about 30% import duty plus 15% VAT. So you'd pay about, and then 3% social welfare tax. So you'd pay about like 48% of the value of the machine normally. But, if you have an investment license and these are capital goods, you can get them in for, you can get the two big taxes removed. So you only pay the 3%. So, okay. It's a very critical.
But what's needed for that, Nemo? What's needed for that? If I want to send you machines license? Today?
Well, if you want to send it to us, we as a company have the investment license. So, we would just charge you the 3% that we pay the government to bring the machines in, and that's it. If you, So it's pretty difficult to get set up and have the operation up and running. And one of the key pieces is investment license. And I think that, oh, by the way, that's another complication, is that even forgetting what we talked about earlier in terms of the agreement for the machines, if you were to sell, if you bring something as an investment and then you want to sell it, then you, then all the, then you'd have to pay the full taxes that I just mentioned.
Right? Say, okay, because, say that one more time. If I bring it in on your 3%,
yeah, well, let's say we bought, in general, not even for Bitcoin, but let's say whatever, if it could be for Bitcoin machines, you know, factory equipment, whatever. Like when you bring stuff under an investment license, that means you're bringing it as a as capital goods, like some stuff that's an investment and that you're going to use to for some productive purpose. So that's the assumption of the investment license. Now, if you turn around and say, okay, I'm going to sell them, then they're like, well, that's not an investment. You're just trading, right? Like you're importing and selling. And then in that case, you would have to pay, you wouldn't get the investment license benefit. So you would have to pay the full import duty. So that means...
Yeah,
that
and this you, is, this yeah. is, these are the hidden pitfalls, right? This is also why I, when... I know Hashbranch is sponsoring the show and I'm working with them. And if clients come to me and they want to host like one or five machines, you know, Ethiopia is always in a discussion. And I say, okay, you know, why would you pay 6 cents in Ethiopia if you can pay 7 or 7.5 in America, where you could then also resell your machines and have all these other benefits, which you don't have in a location like Ethiopia. And if you're doing it only with five machines or so, it doesn't make sense. But these are often the pitfalls that, of course, nobody talks about. Okay, if you want to have the miners in really, really cheap, to summarize, you need to have a partner that imports the goods, knows how to do that, and then you only pay 3% because they have the special license. Now, if you wanted to sell the machine again after 2 years, right, now you can't really do that because as soon as you try, you will get hit with that full import tax, which makes it cost prohibitive in the majority of cases.
Yeah, no, that would not make sense. So the only thing that would make sense in that case would be just to take them back out of the country. But then you paid for shipping twice, so this is the other. And then the other, even forgetting all the taxes and all that thing, all the other stuff, you look at a map, it's, Ethiopia is kind of logistically a pretty expensive place to get stuff in, shipping wise. I mean, but fortunately we have really good air cargo service from pretty much anywhere in the world, so that helps a lot. And we get the best possible prices that way in general. But if you're shipping by sea, it's complicated and probably more expensive. So by air, I think it's pretty competitive. By sea, it's probably quite more expensive than because you still have to get 800 kilometers on land after you get to Djibouti, which is how you would bring here stuff here by sea.
Yeah. Okay, Nemo, let's switch gears a little bit. Repairs. Talk to me about repairs. Where was repairing ASICs a year ago, and where is it today? Do we have repair centers, Bitmain repair centers, MicroBT? Where are we there?
Yeah, so that's a big thing. So this industry has really sprouted. Like we said, there was zero in January last into 2024. And just in the last 15 months, not only has the number, the power consumption gone up and the number of data centers, but in the last probably 4 months, I think, or there has been a couple of places that are official Bitmain repair centers. So I don't know if they're owned by Bitmain, but they have some kind of official relationship where if you have a Bitmain machine under warranty, you can take it to those guys. That's there. MicroBT do not have that yet. I think they're planning to soon, I hope. So that would be nice. I think that'll be a key thing going forward, because like I said, shipping is expensive. So it would make no sense even, you know, to RMA, to return a machine to the manufacturer abroad. So yeah, I think, and given the size of the, you know, the size of the industry here, I'm pretty sure MicroBT will also have authorized. But even if it's not an if it's not an official repair center, you know, different companies like us, we've largely been taking care of our own machines and our, you know, hosting customers' machines. So yeah, at least the basic stuff, we can do it. You know, and anything like capacitors, resistors, you know, like basic components, you can get them locally. So we do those things. And hopefully soon we'll be also stock of like all the, you know, ASIC chips and so on.
You should become the MicroBT repair center.
We'll see. We'll see. We're busy trying to grow our data center for now. But yeah, I think certainly for our hosting customers, we do as much as possible. It's our capacity. Our capacity is increasing in that way as well. So we're doing more things. Yeah.
HashRedUp is sponsored by solomining.de, the place to buy open source home and solo mining devices like the BitX. With about 20 watts of usage, these solo mining devices are perfect to play the lottery from home or from the office. Get 5% off with the code HashRedUp. Thanks to the legends at solomining.de for sponsoring the content. Okay, cool. We talked earlier about transmission, and I know I had a great segue. About transmission being built and Bitcoin mining adding revenue to the electricity provider so that they could build it out more effectively. Now, you know, where do we get started? Maybe talk about, Nemo, how electricity is priced today. And let's get started there in Ethiopia. So where is the power cost and why is it not location dependent?
So yeah, I think that's the location. So right now, the way the power is priced historically is up to now is by industry. So there's so there's a price for cement factories, or there's a price for farmers. There's a price, and then there's a price for Bitcoin miners, data centers that do that. That's kind of the mentality, which is kind of a legacy from our long socialist history, where and the power company has just traditionally not been a business, really. You know, it's becoming that now, but it's more like just a government function, right? And so the residential has this price and so on. So that creates... I think to me that's a very antiquated and very inefficient pricing system, and it creates incentive compatibility problems, as they say in game theory. Because if the government says, "Oh, farming is good, let's give a low price for farmers," and then somebody will be like, "Oh, let me go and put a cement factory on a farm and then make cement, because if you call yourself a farm, you get a better price than if you call yourself a cement factory," or whatever, right? So then it becomes a cat and mouse game, and then that has to be policed and that has to be regulated, it's just an endless inefficiency, because the goal of the buyer and the seller are not compatible, right? So what makes more sense is to say, okay, well, energy is energy. And, you know, what matters is time and place, right? If you give me a kilowatt in this location and there's this much demand and this much supply, then that should determine the price. And that way, it's neutral. It doesn't discriminate based on a buyer. So that would be incentive compatible. And then, you know, the buyer doesn't have to, doesn't have this temptation to play these silly games, and this, you know, and then there's not all that overhead of cracking down on all these things, and then also it naturally leads to a balanced grid, right? Because that means places where, you know, or places or time, and we can talk about those two dimensions there, geographic and temporal, where there's the supply, when the supply exceeds the demand, it should be cheap, and therefore more demand gets attracted to those places if it can get there. That's where Bitcoin is really special. Then that will help because you're selling the power that's available. And then when the demand is higher than the supply, well, the price should be higher, and they will naturally keep it in balance. So that's the way it should be. And I think that's just basically, yeah, supply and demand. But in the case of Ethiopia, you know, the time dimension, I would say right now, is much less important than the spatial dimension, right? Because, you know, like, so, you know, everybody knows in more sophisticated markets, you know, you can have night and day rates and weekend rates and so on because of supply and demand, or even in the renewable energy space, you know, famously ERCOT in Texas, they have a lot of wind power. So when the wind is blowing high, they have a lot of supply. And then when the weather is hot and everybody turns on their air conditioners, you have very high demand. Ironically, those two things are opposite. So they have temporal issues of supply and demand, and then the price is dynamic. So that's really cool and efficient. But that's sort of second order. For us, it's even more basic than that. It's location, right? Because we're growing the grid, the power generation, as I mentioned earlier, has grown, you know, has tripled in the last 3 years. And you sort of have a chicken and egg problem, right? Because taking huge steps, right? And when you add, so you're taking a huge step, which means you have to start generate that power, and then you have to build a transmission and distribution to get that power to the users, and the power generation is often very far away from where the demand is, because it's, you know, the where the dams are is based on the rivers and the high, you know, the geological situation. So you have big steps in generation capacity, and then transmission and distribution have to catch up. And then the consumption will catch up. So this is what we see, is that you have these gaps temporarily, while until the transmission and distribution catch up, you'll have these big gaps. So these gaps are geographic. They're in the places where the generation is larger, and maybe the long distance transmission is built, but the distribution to consumers is not built yet. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's only at the dams, although that's also true, but it could also be at some intermediate points where you have long distance transmission has been built, but then the capillaries, the last mile, has not been built. So for, I think here, the big gaps between supply and demand are geographic. So, you know, we've been advocating very strongly that, well, then if we want, to have efficient pricing, it has to be different by different locations. If we do have that, then that means the power, the excess capacity will attract. If you have a low price for the excess capacity, you'll attract demand, and it will generate revenue from otherwise wasted capacity. And that revenue will improve the bottom line of the power company, and that in turn can be reinvested to accelerate the distribution and transmission. So then, and then when you have more distribution and transmission, you have more consumption. So that means even more revenue, because when you get to everybody, then you can get to the full price of it instead of just the stranded price. And then that means, now you have more money to build more generation, and then the same thing happens again. So you are ideally, and this is where Bitcoin is crucial. I think, you know, our vision and our mission as a company is to say, hey, if we can just go and be flexible and buy these excess capacity, then instead of this being a burden and a problem, it becomes an opportunity because it becomes a virtuous circle where it's more generation means more revenue, more distribution, then that in turn means more revenue again. That means you can reinvest it in more generation and so on. So that's how I think we can get to 100 gigawatts.
Are you, Nemo, advocating for a free market, which is probably the ideal goal, especially for energy markets? As I've said before, you know, a free market or any meddling in electricity markets make it inefficient, and keeping demand and supply in balance at 50 hertz becomes difficult. Or are you advocating for more government regulation to be more specific and more location based, and for the regulation to become more complicated in a sense?
No, I think yes, you're right. I think that, you know, market based would be the most efficient, but you have to be pragmatic, right? So two things. One is that, to have a truly real time dynamic pricing, you know, take a few steps, just like, you know, they have. I think the two best examples are caught in Texas, Nord Pool in the Scandinavia, and actually they also distribute to a bunch of other non-Scandinavian countries, I think 11 or 12 countries. They have, you know, a truly dynamic market. That's a few steps down the road. I think pragmatically what we want is at least the location-based component. So it may not be real-time, but it's still supply and demand-based, and you say, okay, you know, you can still have annual contracts or whatever, but then not 5-minute pricing, but 1-year pricing, but at least say, okay, well, for this place, you know, we know that for the next 1 year, the demand is going to be very high, so it's got to be expensive, and we've got to control it by not having too much demand given the supply. And then these other places, we have a lot of supply, and it's just wasted, so let's make it low to attract whoever can come and buy it there. So it's just more like, I would say, a more pragmatic commercial basis than rather, you know, a more than some kind of theoretical ideal. So I think that would be the very important first step. And it's not impossible, even in our current reality. Like, you know, the best success story in Ethiopia is the airline, right? State-owned. And it's a very strategic thing. It's not like a private company that just came out. It's the government invested, very long-term vision, and it's a huge success. But it's accepted in that case, because it's so successful and it has a great history, that, yeah, if, you know, a plane ticket from Addis Ababa to Bangkok, it doesn't say, well, this is the price for a tourist, and this is a price for a businessman, and this is a price for a dentist, and this is a price for a pharmacist, which is how electricity is. It's like, no, this seat from this location to this location at this time of year, supply and demand, we're going to sell it this way, you know, and then, you know, there is a precedent for this.
It would be interesting to see what happens if there was a second airline, because Ethiopian Airlines is, you know, competing on a global scale in a free market, because there's no government that regulates everything, right? So to an extent, the Ethiopian government is forced to expose the state-owned or state-invested company to the evil that is global capitalism, or whatever, however they may
see. It has kept it on. That's true. That's true. But it's still, the government should still get credit, not just this government, but all of the governments of the last, you know, 80 years since the airline started. It's kind of this thing where they said, well, okay, yeah, either just let it operate commercially, let the experts figure out what's the price of a plane, what's the price of a seat, what's the supply and demand, where should we fly, where should we not fly, what time, how many times, all that stuff. There's been, you know, and periodic episodes, every time the government changes, you know, in term, in Ethiopia, not this last time, fortunately, so that's to their credit, but in the previous couple of times when, you know, when there's the revolution, the new government comes in, they're like, okay, no, we're going to make this airline, and then they try to dictate it, and then it will start off. Because the it's a global competition, it kind of, it immediately starts failing, so then they're like, oh, okay, wait, let's leave it alone and let it operate professionally as
one
a
thing,
business.
One thing that I wanted to add also to the electricity discussion is recently there was a price hike, right, by the IMF imposing taxes, if I'm not mistaken. What can you first say, Nemo, what is the price for miners in Ethiopia per kilowatt hour today that the government has come up with? And is that, what can you say about the what I just said about the IMF imposing more
taxes? So the price, it's... It used to be a secret, but I think it's been out around enough times now that, you have, by the time you add some taxes, the final price you pay is like 3.6 cents in the US. That's now pretty public, so it's that's the price.
And is it? Sorry, tag along question. Now, is it denominated in dollars or is it denominated in Ethiopian birr?
In dollars, yeah.
Okay,
that's the price in dollars. So going back, I think before I get to the IMF or like price hikes question, so the to your question about free markets or the commercial approach, the big part of it is consumer prices, right? Like the price you pay at home. That's sort of a separate question, because it's actually a different company called the wholesale company, and they're both state owned, but about 15 years ago or 10 years ago they split the company into two. There's the utility and then there's the wholesale generation and transmission company. So on the utility level to consumers, I think we're not even pushing or advocating for drastic changes there, because it's heavily subsidized. It's very much a social welfare type thing, and I think that the pricing there is probably much harder to change. But if you kind of can fix the wholesale level for large commercial buyers, then the amount of the retail side of things can be more explicitly subsidized. So that's what I would advocate, is to say, well, okay, if the price, if the, the supply and demand says the price should be, 4 cents in the city or 5 cents, but the government wants to say, well, we want to subsidize it and make it 2 cents, then fine, let's just call that what it is. It's like 3 cents of welfare, and that's just an explicit subsidy that we decide to do as a society. We say, okay, we're going to subsidize poor people or whatever, right? Like, so I think the for the retail side, the final price to the consumer may still be subsidized, but if you kind of have a functioning, efficient market for energy as a whole, and then you just tack on that subsidy at the end, that's, I think you can still have the efficiency and still have that cost be accepted. So that's the reality. Now, what has happened in the last year, actually since September, although it was building up for a while, there was a major reform. On the retail prices, what people pay at home, used to be very, very, very low. Like, the prices had been fixed. Again, going back to the socialist era, and they had stayed fixed. And it's also the same for a few other things, like house, government-owned houses that have rents that haven't been changed in 30 years and things like that. You still have quite a bit of that. So they decided last and starting in the Ethiopian New Year in September, they started introducing. They announced a series, like a 4-year plan that, okay, we're going to catch up because these prices are kind of way too out of date. So they didn't do it all at once, but they announced the schedule. So there's an increase, and then there'll be another increase next September and so on. So that's probably what you hear about when you say, oh, they announced some price increases. It's like the household, the retail prices have, yes, were increased and will continue to be increased for the next 4 years.
Okay.
Or so. Yeah.
What I heard was that the IMF had given Ethiopia another loan. And as a condition to that loan, they said, look, you got to increase electricity tariffs or add an additional tax.
I don't know the details of if that particular point was explicitly demanded. But yeah, I think it's the general thing is that, yeah, well, you have these things that are, I think the general push when the IMF lends money, or even in the case of in the World Bank, which is more project financing for like actual, what you're hearing could also be from about the World Bank, where they say, okay, we will help you finance transmission, or we will help you finance generation, but it has to make sense, so you have to adjust it. Their general push, though, is to liberalize the economy, right? And to sort of fix some of these legacy issues. So yeah, and it's true that the old prices were, I mean, like so low and it was just not sustainable. And you can see it in the infrastructure here. We have power outages all the time in every city. The poles are falling down. You know, generators are blowing up left and right. You know, the last mile distribution is in really poor shape, and then you have somebody, you know, that you could have situations where somebody's got power and they're paying like 1/10 of the cost of delivering it to them, you know? So I think there is a general push to liberalize things and to fix things. And yeah, I think it's a fair point. You know, I'm not a big fan of IMF imposing stuff. I think that just if the IMF says so, everybody hates the IMF, right? but if the IMF, and that may be justified, but if the IMF says, hey, the sky is blue, you don't have to go and say like the sky is green, right? Like sometimes what they're saying does make sense, and I think it's true that the retail prices did need to be adjusted. It may not reach a free market ideal, but it has to be a little more sustainable. And by the way, you know, like, you know, one concern I hear, and I want to talk about this a bit, like the consumer prices versus industrial prices. Everywhere in the world, even in poor countries, the consumer can tolerate a higher price, even in a poor country, right? You know, like if you can spend the consumer, let's say even in Ethiopia, average household, if they spend the equivalent of $5, $10 a month on electricity, that's affordable for the average. Maybe not for the poor, but let's say the average, which is poor by global standards. So $5 a month, but that's, if you've translated per kilowatt hour, that might be like 5-6 cents, right? So it's not like, so the point is that the wholesale, but then a factory, which, you know, may not, or like a metal aluminum smelter or a cement factory may not be sort of viable at 5 cents or 6 cents.
No, because it has to compete globally.
Yeah. So I think the in general, whenever you see these market-based electricity markets, the it's usually the consumers who chase away the industrial users, not vice versa, right? Because the fear is that, oh, big industry will come and then all the poor people will not have any electricity. But the reality is actually the reverse. It's like if you have supply and demand-based pricing, what happens is the factories are forced to move away from the people. They don't want to be in the city because they can't keep up with the price of what you would be willing to pay at home.
Yeah.
So because naturally they have a higher price point. The consumer has a higher price point.
Now, just to, I asked this earlier, but I don't think it came through clearly. When you get your power bill SQRB Labs, right? Mm-hmm. Is that power bill and that invoice denominated in birr, and you are telling me what the US price is because you calculated the dollar price, or is it actually denominated from the power company in dollars?
It can be either way. Now, currently for, I won't say what it is for us, but for in general, it's, you know, if you're the contracts that have been signed with the foreign customers are in dollars. And that was a huge deal at the part, you know, initially. But another big thing that happened last year is the exchange rate was liberalized. So now that's not such a big issue, right? Because whether you pay in birr or dollars, you know, it's just like paying in dollars or euros. Doesn't really matter, right? If you want, somebody wants you to pay in dollars, you'll just convert your euros into dollars and pay them. But before, the official exchange rate was half of the market rate. So it's like we talked about this in the last podcast, but it was a complete national obsession to be like, this is in dollars, this is in birr, and it's like basically like this 50% gap was massive. So, but fortunately,
It still matters if you denominate all your, like, let's say, I don't know, the birr strengthens against the dollar, which is weakening right now, and all your contracts are denominated with your customers in dollars, and now, you know, you make less money. That does matter. Yeah. I mean, I very much looked at the dollar-euro exchange rate recently, because it literally went from 103 to now 115, which is massive, you know?
So, I mean, I think any multinational company or business, not even if whether it's or a company that has suppliers and customers that are in different places, deals with currency fluctuations and risks. Those are first world problems. Like, you know, I'm going to hedge my Forex exposure and like maybe 5%, 10%. It's very sophisticated. And no, it's true. Like for like companies like Google or Apple, this is like, billions and tens of billions of dollars are gained or lost based on these exchange rates. And they have to be very sophisticated about that. But I think we're coming from a world where it was much, much, much more than that. It was just like double or nothing. If we have I think if we move to a point where it is like the global market, where exchange rate goes up and down, maybe you gain here, you lose there. You try to, if that's not your main business, you try to hedge it so that you're neutral and you don't care. We shouldn't, I don't want to be spending time thinking about exchange rates. I want to be like running data centers, right? Like that's everybody Fair should enough. Be, not everybody should be a financial engineering their Forex, right?
Nemo, to close out, because we're already 7 minutes over time. Where do you want the electricity market? What's realistic? Where's the electricity market in Ethiopia in 25 years? And how do you see Bitcoin mining then? And yeah, anything else that you wish I had asked but didn't, feel free to close it out.
Yeah, so my dream and our vision as a company is to say, okay, well, and I think we can, I think it's real, it's possible. Is to say, well, okay, we have this virtuous cycle where energy generation capacity is growing. Bitcoin miners are running in there to use the excess capacity when it's there, the stranded capacity by going to the locations where it is, generating that revenue. That revenue gets reinvested in transmission distribution. And then, that overall revenue can then be invested in more growth. And I think that in 25 years, we could sustain a growth rate that gets us to 100 gigawatts, even in less than that. I would say even in 10 years, and that's 1,000%. It's like the equivalent of 20 GERDs, but I think that's possible. And that's where. But I think that for that to happen, we really have to get the pricing to turn it into a positive engine, so that electricity is a source of growth and self-sustaining, as opposed to being a cost where the government has to put money into electricity, and it's always like taking something else and putting it in there. And to me, that's the ultimate goal, I think, bigger even than the specifics of Bitcoin mining in this country, is that if you can each, as I always say, like each gigawatt of or each kilowatt of electricity is each kilowatt hour of electricity is 40 cents of GDP. So if you think of just monetizing the excess capacity that we have today, we could and reinvesting that into growth, we could be talking about, you know, increasing, adding $40-50 billion to the GDP of the country, and that's, you know, energy's prosperity. So I hope that with the right pricing, Bitcoin mining can be sort of the catalyst for this engine that really achieves massive levels of economic prosperity for the country.
I think energy is prosperity is a good final word. Nemo, I know you guys work relentlessly on your own data center, on your own sites, and also on actually seeing the change.